ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For most of us, the art market is a complete mystery. Famous paintings are sold for what seem to be excessive prices, hundreds of millions of dollars. For most of those paintings, there's no doubt about who painted them and when, but not all of them. And where there's money, big money, there are unscrupulous people wanting to exploit the weaknesses of others, and the art world is no different. Gareth Fletcher is Director of Art and Technology at the Sotheby's Institute of Art in London, although he actually does that job from here in Australia. He's with us this morning to explain how the art market works and how the authenticity of what you are buying with your tens of millions of dollars is established beyond doubt. Gareth, welcome to Overnights.
Good morning, Rob. Thank you very much for inviting me to the program.
You know, one of the things about the art industry, the art market, is people always think that the paintings are getting more and more expensive. Is that right?
You know, if you took a sort of an analysis of the last 10 or 15 years of the art market, and you sort of take out, I guess, the sort of the bounce, or what you, how you might refer to it after the financial crisis 2008, etc., and then take out the what sort of happened during 2020, 2021 with the pandemic, you see a very consistent dollar value of the international art market. It's usually sort of hovering around sort of 55 to 65 billion US dollars. And it sort of doesn't tend to fluctuate very, very much. I guess that market value incorporates all different collecting categories. So, you know, contemporary art, old masters, antiquities, all the sort of everything sort of put in together into that one sum. But I think this is sort of I guess there's not a huge amount of inflation actually in that market. It's a good point you made.
What about when new players come into the market, like we have seen from some areas of the world in the last 20 years or so, that are cashed up and want to buy those old masters, for example, maybe a Leonardo da Vinci painting, that aren't on the market? How do they affect the market?
That's a really good question. So what tends to happen is that when it comes to old master pictures in general, sadly, the artists are dead. So you've got a very clear sort of limitation on supply there, which means that by and large, the majority of the best works, some of the most sort of famous works tend to be in museums. And we sort of can refer to museums as a bit of sort of a cultural graveyard. Often once they go in there, they sort of never really leave. And so what that means is that you have the finite supply. You have, I guess, maybe a sort of an ever-degrading level of quality if the best ones are going into museums and the others are coming into the market. And I think really what ends up happening is that sort of conversations behind closed doors happen between individuals who maybe, as you say, have pretty cashed up and they really want a sort of a token piece that they can talk about, etc. And then, you know, if the price is right, they'll always find a way of twisting someone's arm. You probably won't read about it, but it'll certainly be something will happen. And then that might be reported by the media or it may not. That's the next stage of that conversation.
So for people who want that certain painting, but, you know, maybe it's in a gallery or maybe it's in private hands and they really want it, what options are available to them?
Right. So if you really want it, then you're going to have a conversation with an advisor, with a dealer, someone at the auction house perhaps, and basically lay out your terms and say, listen, I really want that. Let's take an example. I really want a as yet reasonably unattributed Leonardo da Vinci. Well, it turns out that over time, a recent example has emerged, Salvator Mundi. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the authenticity.
And where it is as well.
Precisely. Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's an interesting sort of discussion around credulity when it comes to the stories that you might be hearing about the potential for a work of art to be authentic. And, you know, everyone would love to own a Leonardo. So the more experts that sort of chime in and say, based on these factors and criteria, I do suggest it's authentic. And then, of course, you have the dissenting voices on the other side of the trench who'll say, well, actually, for those particular reasons, it may not be authentic. What on earth has a Leonardo done hiding for 300, 400 years suddenly to emerge? And I think it's in that kind of opacity there's no sort of real clear objectivity about these discussions, and that's the interesting aspect, that within that kind of that sort of that liminal opacity, whatever you might want to call it, you tend to get areas of potential criminal activity emerging in various forms.
Gareth Fletcher is our guest, Director of Art and Technology at the Sotheby's Institute of Art in London. But rather than, say, Leonardo da Vinci, that was $450 million plus more, perhaps, there are other works. In Australia, it's quite often a Brett Whiteley painting, or it could be work by an Indigenous artist. Perhaps that's less well known how many works that those artists have done. How do we guard against crime, forgery, deception, larceny, that sort of thing in regards to paintings like that?
Right. So I would say there are mitigation sort of techniques that you can use and employ to try and avoid criminal aspects of works of art in some ways. The first thing I would suggest is that the most important thing, because this is sort of where my research is going, is finding out the backstory of the work of art. So working out what they call the provenance of the work of art, and just sort of finding out where has this work of art been, with whom has it been, and why was it in that context? So basically tracing a sort of an ownership history of a work of art, especially if it's significant, people should be aware of it, or at least have an understanding that it did exist. So I think determining the provenance, so really sort of finding out as much information about its biography, the work's biography, as possible, really, really important. The other thing I'd suggest is that when it sort of comes to the whole process of acquiring a work of art that, you know, might be of a potentially large amount of money, etc., there's a sort of a basic process that you would undertake for many other transactions in life, you know, due diligence. And I think adequate due diligence is something which is really hard to pin down in the art trade. But what you might want to do is you might want to talk to a few different people who are aware of some of the different databases for stolen works of art, aware of some of the different names, maybe historically, that you might want to avoid, especially if they had the work in their custody or in their ownership. You might potentially want to avoid those names because they may potentially be associated with buying and selling what might have turned out to be fake or forged works of art, potentially. So you might want to sort of avoid, eschew hanging, purchasing works that have their name in the provenance, but really just asking as many questions as absolutely possible about the work, because there's a sort of a weird old trope in the art trade, bit of Latin, caveat emptor, which effectively means the buyer beware. So listen, you know, there's not a huge amount of recourse to action if you end up purchasing reasonably blindly or blinkered in some capacity a work of art that turns out 5, 7, 12 years later to perhaps not be exactly what you thought it was that you purchased. In other words, maybe being disattributed or deattributed away from the artist that you thought it was by. So there's not a sort of a huge amount of sympathy for people sort of rushing in and trying to buy the big ticket work of art without asking a few salient questions. And, you know, if it all seems a bit too good to be true, what do we say? Mm. Walk away, I think. That's the key point.
The thing is, though, that if you do buy something and pay a lot of money for an artwork that then turns out not to be by the artist that you are told it was, then what happens? What recourse do you have against perhaps the auction house who sold it in good faith and you bought it in good faith?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, we would want to avoid those situations if you can in any way. I think what you have to think about is, what jurisdiction are you purchasing in? What form of common or civil law protections do you have? How do you define good faith? And are there any statutes of limitations around that process? In other words, are there any expiry periods around the assertion of good faith? Then you've got to ask, well, are you buying this work of art on the open market? Is the dealer signing a letter of guarantee or a warranty that the work of art is what it purports to be and what they're selling it to you for? What I think at that point, when you're really sort of pushing in to the dealer and saying, listen, I want you to write that, I want you basically to sign an affidavit that what you're selling me right here is what I'm buying. You know, at that point, if you start to see them sort of slightly sweating under the collar or kind of asking you if you want a cup of tea or something like that, then I would suggest stepping back and not parting with your hard-earned money until you've asked a sort of a third party. Because at the end of the day, a lot of these matters sometimes end up in court, sometimes get sort of adjudicated in certain ways. And it's not uncommon for the dealer to assert that, you know, they're selling you something which they are purporting that, for the best, to the best degree of their knowledge, the work is authentic. However, there's possibly a caveat right at the end of the terms and conditions of sale that says, listen, this is based on the amount of information we have right now. We can't foresee what the future will bring. In other words, you know, what happens if an archive opens up in 5 years' time that actually completely disavows that work of art, and it actually turns out that it was by a forger who was very happy to have tried to sell it as a Whiteley and succeeded in doing so. But here's the evidence that it's in their studio as a forgery or a fake or similar. So I think it's a tricky line being a dealer in all of this. And I would definitely suggest just asking as many people as possible before you commit those funds.
Because if you can't tell whether something painted in the last 50 years is genuine, how can you be sure that something painted 500 years ago is genuine? Tell me about the process of authenticating a work of art, especially by an old master, or even by, you know, someone more recent than that.
Yeah, sure. So one thing I think a really important resource, if it exists for the artist, is a thing called a catalogue raisonné. Those are meant to be objectively compiled records of all the works undertaken or completed by the artist during their lifetime, sort of their oeuvre, as it were. And if the picture is in that, that's a good start. Now, the authors of these catalogues, and as I said before, hopefully it's objectively compiled, but sometimes you get dealers who sometimes have a bit of skin in the game, might be, shall we say, you know, publishing works that they would ambitiously hope would can be included in those tomes. And that's happened many times. So be careful of that. The second thing I'd say is when we talk about authenticity, there's sort of a kind of a metaphor of a sort of a three-pillared stool. I mentioned before about provenance. So really, really drill down in the ownership history of the work of art, find out with whom it's been, where it's been, and when. That's really important. Second thing I think is we can, there's a phrase I use in the trade, it's called connoisseurship. But effectively, it's an individual, shall we say, who's been exposed to works of art by particular artists for decades and decades and decades. And again, this is very arbitrary and very subjective, but people would argue that they've created a sort of an awareness of works. They've got the eye for an artist. They know which works are and which are less likely to be owned by an artist. So they'll often market themselves as an expert in that artist's, you know, output. So, you know, there's a Rembrandt expert, there's a Monet, Degas, etc. And you would want to consult that person just to sort of see if the old smell test, they say, no, there's no way. And then you want to ask more questions. The third leg of this metaphorical stool is scientific analysis, or it's also referred to as technical art history. That's where you actually employ, you know, really specific imaging, you know, spectrographic tools, photographs, different forms of analyses onto the materiality of the picture. So you're basically taking really, really sort of high resolution photographs, infrared photographs, ultraviolet photographs, etc. You're potentially examining or subjecting the actual picture surface to some form of hopefully non-invasive material analysis. So looking at like pigment analysis, that kind of thing, picking a tiny little sort of slither of a pigment and working out, is it correct that pigment did exist when this artist is purported to have painted the work of art? Or, you know, was that pigment invented in 1960 and this is a work that's purporting to be from 1620? And if that's the case, then, you know, that's probably a bit of a sort of a red flag, as I say, that you might want to sort of ask a few more questions. So science can be really, really helpful in determining the potential of a work of art. Also, by looking through the kind of the outer surface of a picture, what we might saw, you know, we might use the sort of the white light example that humans can see. If you look at it sort of from an ultraviolet or an infrared perspective, you can actually start to see some really interesting things if they exist underneath that surface layer. So you might be able to see some underdrawing, sort of carbon. You might be able to see some potential conservation, evidence of conservation. So you might actually see that someone's put a little bit of kind of what we might say a little bit of additive restoration, a bit of ambitious restoration at some point in its history, and then kind of varnished over it, you know, just to sort of potentially, I don't know, just to change how it looks from examination from a human. So I would say, you know, those three legs of that metaphorical stool, really good things to keep the stool upright. And then again, once you've consulted the catalogue raisonné, you might want to, again, just ask a trusted third party, someone that you can just, who's got no skin in the game, say, you know, have you heard about this picture? Oh, okay, and just get their thoughts on it.
Okay. We're talking about art forgery, the art market. Gareth Fletcher is our guest. That's all very well to determine, for example, when you're talking about those pigments, when you're testing it, did it really come from 1620 or something? But that doesn't necessarily even tell you that the artist who signed their name or whose work looks like that work of art actually painted it. It might have been done by somebody in their studio, and that was a common thing as well. How can you be sure, even if they put their name on it, that Leonardo painted it, or Raphael, or any of those people?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely it's something that's really important to consider, especially when you think about the guild system, the apprentice system. You know, you mentioned this is sort of very common back in the, well, I guess in the Renaissance, especially. So you would just hope, and this is where that connoisseurial element might come in. Because, let's say, for instance, if you're thinking about the apprentice system, often the master, i.e. let's just say the Raphael, for instance, would be entrusted. They would be the person that ends up painting the kind of the really, really specific bits, like the face, the hands, the kind of the finer details. And it's at that point, you know, they would you would want to examine those aspects of a picture. And again, this is really, really tricky to prove, but you're asking someone who's seen a lot of authentic Raphael works to then look at your work and say, listen, do those fingers, just as a kind of the shadowing, the sfumato, the chiaroscuro, the kind of the light and shade modeling, does that all sort of seem right for this particular artist? And if they believe so, well, you know, you would then, of course, want to consult the catalogue as an A. If the work of art is in that, brilliant. If it's not, then you're going to be asking more questions. You're going to be asking, and this is where it becomes really subjective, to what degree does the studio assistant, does their intervention on the work of art constitute or deconstitute it being considered now authentic? In other words, like if the master, you know, created, say, 20% of the work of art and the studio assistant created, say, 80% of the art, conceptually, does that matter to you when you're looking at it now? You think, well, I think it's authentic, you know. So there's always a kind of a bit of a toing and a froing, as it were, when we have these discussions. Yeah. Broadly speaking, I think it calls into question the way that we actually understand authenticity and what value we sort of as a 21st century consumer of culture, what value we actually sort of ascribe to that. Is it really important that the work of art is 100% by the artist? Well, if that's the case, then you might want to start thinking about acquiring works that are made in a later period where you can actually clearly demonstrate that the artist had painted it, maybe by asking them if they're still alive. Did you paint that picture? You did? Yeah. I'm very happy.
But then with someone like Andy Warhol, yeah, you might have a Warhol on your wall, could be a silkscreen print that somebody else did, but you know that it's likely that somebody in the factory did that, but Andy Warhol is still ascribed as the painter, the creator, the artist.
Yeah, 100%. And this is the beauty of pop art and of Andy Warhol's vision. You know, he's basically saying, listen, he's throwing the kind of the concept of authenticity pretty much sort of out the window and saying, listen, I am the artist. I'm the person who created the concept of these works. My concept is all about mass production, consumerism, 15 minutes of fame, all that kind of thing. So actually, if you buy into my vision, then you're also buying into the fact that my hand probably didn't actually touch that work of art. And then on top of all of that, if you think about kind of the market, if you sort of take that conceptual lens and apply it to, well, actually, how many works of art did Warhol create? Suddenly you start to think, well, hang on, are there plenty more that exist on museum walls and people's houses, etc., that have not been, shall we say, formally popped into the catalogue, but they are Warhols because they were created at the factory at the time. And there's evidence of that, for instance. So, I mean, Jean-Michel Basquiat, another great example. We don't know how many works of art of his exist, but they still sell for a lot of money. So, you know, and from what I can understand, there's not a huge amount of catalogue evidence for the actual works that he did create in his lifetime. Okay. So, yeah, again, it's all a bit conceptual, isn't it, really?
Then beyond that, we have actual works of art that are definitely done by the painters who perhaps put their name to it, but then they're stolen. Now, there's a famous case in a gallery in Boston, the Isabella Stewart Gallery, 1990, 13 works of art were stolen. They're still talked about now. There were some Rembrandts, Manet, Degas, there was a Vermeer as well. There aren't that many Vermeers around. What's the market? Who's buying a Vermeer that is stolen from an art gallery? Because you can have it on your wall of your house, of course, but no one can ever see it. You're the only person that would know that you had it. That's pretty cold comfort, isn't it? What about the market for stolen works like that, like by really big names?
Yeah, it's a wonderful catch-22. You want to steal the most valuable work of art you possibly can, but by the very nature of it being valuable, it's also exceptionally well exposed, and you certainly can't find an avenue through which to actually to convert that into cold hard cash. So Absolutely. So the Isabella Stewart Garden Museum example is a great one. Broadly speaking, I don't think anyone actually fully knows where those works of art are. One of a close colleague many years ago, Charlie Hill, he tried his hardest to find them. He's an art detective, art cop. He tried to find them. Many people tried to find them. And this is sort of, I guess this is the evidence of the problem of that kind of that contradiction, which is these are really important works of art, but there's no one wants to touch a hot work of art by Vermeer because, you know, effectively they can't resell it. Those works of art, the sad thing about them is that the sort of the miscalculation of the moment where someone stole, let's say a Vermeer, for instance, that miscalculation, suddenly when they realize they've got something which is hot on their hands, they can't fence it for good money, they can't do a lot with it. Well, then those works of art potentially might actually end up being materially affected. Like they might not be conserved very well. They might be sort of stuffed in the boot of a car or, you know, and then, you know, you have relative humidity that might impact them. Suddenly they start to get a bit of foxing around the edge and then they start to go a bit moldy. And these are, you know, when they were on the gallery wall, they were a Vermeer. Now they're sort of a moldy sort of specimen of something which looks like a Vermeer in the back of a Volvo. And that's not exactly sort of where the criminal intended that work of art to be. I still don't understand where the sort of the metrics of this come from, but some people have suggested that you might get up to 10% of the work's retail value on the illicit market. I don't like using the word black market. I think that's not at all appropriate. The illicit market. So that 10%, say you've got a work of art worth 30 million, well, apparently 3 million. I mean, again, good luck trying to find the person who's going to hand over that.
They would have been stolen to order, surely, that somebody wanted some of these Dutch masters or a Manet or Degas, some French painters. The people who stole from that particular gallery weren't just going in and grabbing the first things they saw.
No, and this is a real argument across the art crime network. Is there a person who commissions thefts? Many people, you know, vehemently say no. They say that most thefts are just opportunistic. You know, I don't really fully believe that. Because there are certain works of art that I know that have been stolen historically that do not have a particularly buoyant public market value. They are pretty specific works of art, and I suggest they're probably sitting on certain people's walls, and they're very happy about that. So the one of the kind of the issues here is that what role do the insurance companies play in all of this? You know, sometimes they get embroiled in processes of recovery. You know, do they pay a little bit of a fee to someone who knows someone who thinks they know where it might be? That might be where you can realize some kind of value in the act of theft. But as you know, as you suggest, there's very little you can do with those works of art aside from sit with them in your study and don't invite anyone around who might know what they are, because they might quietly mention that to someone else, and that's you being telephoned at 2 a.m. by the police. So it's an issue, isn't it?
Yeah. We're talking about the illicit art market with Gareth Fletcher. Okay, what about forgeries then? Are paintings forged and then on sold either to galleries or to individuals and people can't tell the difference? Or is that no longer the case because, as you say, of the spectrographic analysis and that sort of thing, x-rays even, that these days you know when something was painted?
Yeah, forgeries still plague the market. The best forgeries are the ones that, you know, we just don't even know exist, and that's success right there. Certainly, I think when it comes to forging works of art, it's a really, really tricky one, because imitation, so sitting in a gallery and imitating a work of art, because you want to, you know, become better at drawing or better at painting, that's existed for centuries. It's when you conduct the process with the proactive motivation to confuse or to mislead. If you do that proactively, then that's how we separate forgeries from fakes. So it's the intention to deceive from the outset that helps define a forgery from a fake. A fake being an original object where something might have just been added to it. So you might have a picture of a still life, you know, and you might just sort of add a kind of an image or something on top of the original work. The work might be 300 years old. You just might do a little bit of sort of painting to the side just to kind of add a characteristic that some, you know, art historian in the future might say, actually, that characteristic, I think we need to reattribute that work to another artist who had that characteristic in their work, and that artist might be more valuable on the market, for instance. But forgeries certainly do exist, and time again, you see, especially auction houses, getting embroiled in having historically consigned works of art, so basically taking them in for sale, having undertaken as much due diligence for those works as possible, again, with the caveat that you've only got the resources that you have at the time. And if you think about that retrospectively, you know, if you were researching a picture 25 years ago, did you have the internet to consult prior to deciding whether to sell it, for instance? And then when you're happy that the work, you've asked enough questions, you're taking the work in to sell, you know, you've got to be very careful about that work because you're trusting a lot of the elements at the time. So the information, the consigner, the provenance, all that kind of stuff. All these things are kind of, you're a bit of a sort of a hostage to fortune potentially, because they may unravel in the future when more information comes to light. And you do see that, you know, large auction houses are still behind the scenes, you know, trying to unravel some of the objects that they did consign to sale 10, 15 years ago that are coming out and actually, well, now they bear evidence that they were not by the artist that that the purchaser was led to believe. So in a kind of a protection sort of perspective, from a legal perspective, auction houses will often promote the authenticity of the work of art for a period of time. So they won't say, listen, this is a work by Rubens and we will stand by that for the future forever. More cannily, they'll say something like, listen, to the information that we've got right now, based on our, you know, the information we've got, we're going to offer a warranty of authenticity that this work of art is by and is being sold as a Rubens, by Rubens, for a period of, say, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. And then again, it sort of puts the onus back on the buyer. Say, well, hang on, are you happy with those terms? If you are, carry on with the transaction. If you're not, then you don't have to buy the work of art. And again, as I say, there are just ongoing cases of forgeries that are sort of just popping up in museum collections and gallery inventories. So it's an endlessly interesting area to research.
So are those paintings likely not to sell for the same sorts of prices where there is an absolute guarantee that this is a work by this particular artist?
Yeah, absolutely. So what will happen is if the auction house is not 100% certain about the work of art, they'll use a form of nomenclature, sort of a semantics to indicate that. So instead of saying it's by Rubens, and, you know, for instance, you can tell they're selling it as Rubens because they'll put the word Peter Paul Rubens and they'll put it in bold, and that's what they're selling it as. If they're not quite sure, they think it's pretty close to a Rubens, but they don't want to be sort of held to account in 3, 4, 5, 6 years' time. They'll pop a attributed to in front of Peter Paul Rubens, and that's them saying, listen, it's up to you if you want to buy it and try and undertake a bit more research to prove the market that actually it is by Rubens, and well done for doing that. That's great. But if they're not particularly, if they just don't want to take that risk, or they've been burnt for factors like this before, they'll pop attributed to. There are other circle of, manner of, style of, school of. They can sort of pop all these sort of prefixes in front of the name of the artist. And as a buyer, again, it's up to you to research, well, actually, what does that legally mean when I'm buying something as manner of? Is it even from the same country, or is it even from the same time frame? Well, maybe manner of doesn't actually mean that. Maybe it means something completely different. Because auction houses, especially, have been around for hundreds of years, they've they've seen the other side of the authenticity discussion many times before, and they often proceed with caution, especially when they don't want to avoid their names being dragged through the mud through litigation.
But, you know, if you buy that painting and you really want it to be a Rubens and you put it on your wall, rather than on a gallery wall, but on your wall at home, who's ever going to come around and say, you know what, that's not a Rubens? No one's going to do a further check. You can say, I've got a Rubens.
Absolutely. And I 100% advocate for that perspective. You know, at the end of the day, appreciation of culture is so subjective. You know, you might not like Andy Warhol, but you might like Peter Paul Rubens. And it's up to you to kind of have your own individual understanding of what you think is valuable. Defining value, is value for you just the good feeling that you get when you stand in front of a picture? Is it, I don't know, is it the fact that the work of art is worth lots of money? Is that important to you? Or is it just, yeah, waking up, having a little smile, looking at that work of art, saying, pretty sure I've got a Rubens. Yeah, I'm very, very happy.
Gareth, thank you so much. It's been fascinating. I really enjoyed it.
Not at all, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.